Wars over nature.
These fights are going on in literally thousands of communities all over the Deer's Historic Range, which is the eastern third of the United States. And these deer fights that I've been to endless deer problem meetings in communities, and I can tell you that the average deer fight in one of these communities lasts about 10 years.
That's journalist Jim Sterba. We talk with him all about the growing battles over wildlife in America's cities and suburbs, about deer, beavers, geese, bears, feral cats, and more. That's what's on today's docket on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riana. When European settlers came to this land, they found the forests, plains, water, and airways teeming with wildlife. It didn't take all that long to wipe most of it almost entirely out. The passenger pigeon, extinct. Beaver, almost extinct. The same with deer. But there's been a comeback of wildlife to urban and suburban areas. As fewer and fewer people hunt, natural predators were extirpated, and the forests grew back, especially in the Northeast. Populations of deer, beavers, coyotes, and other animals are now growing, and in some places becoming nuisances to the human inhabitants. My guest, Jim Sterba, says it's a wildlife comeback miracle that's turning into a mess, setting neighbor against neighbor in ferocious battles fought out in town councils and in the courts. It's not just that humans are expanding into wildlife territory. Wildlife is coming into established neighborhoods where they've learned the living is easy and the humans are tame. But some people want to get tough. They want deer out of their gardens and off their roadways, geese off their golf courses, and beavers to stop flooding their properties. Jim Sterba describes himself as a newspaper man. He's been a foreign and national correspondent since the 1960s, working for the New York Times and then the Wall Street Journal. He's covered wars in Asia, including Vietnam, Indonesia, and Pakistan. In his latest book, he turns his attention to the conflicts here at home over just how much wildlife are people willing to live with. His book is called Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds. Jim Sterba, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Happy to be here.
Well, I was delighted to find out about the existence of this book, Nature Wars, because I found out about it just as a nature war over deer was coming to a white-hot heat where I live on the east end of Long Island. We'll get into that a little bit later, but I want to say, first of all, you say that this book tells the story of how we turned the wildlife comeback miracle into a mess. Explain that statement.
Well, remember that for the first 400 years of European settlement in this country, we destroyed forests and wildlife leading up to the end of the 19th century when it was so egregious that it was called the era of extermination. Then over the next 100 years, conservationists slowly brought lots of remnant populations back to health. And only in the last few decades, depending on the species, did we get them back to the point where people began to question whether we had too many of them. And the third thing that happened besides the comeback of wildlife and forests was the sprawl of people out of cities after the Second World War into suburbs and exurbs and into sprawl. So the mess that I describe is this combination of people, of wildlife living amongst the trees out there and in the countryside, and growing number of conflicts that have been occurring with a whole range of species, which cause people to fight amongst themselves over what to do or what not to do about essentially too much of a good thing.
Yeah, and those fights are really intense over species, not just deer, but also beaver, over geese. I have experience of all three of those, if not some more, of the ones that you talk about. You know, it's so interesting because the news is full of predictions that we're in the midst of the sixth great extinction of species. Your book doesn't deny that, but it focuses on this comeback of certain species from the edge of extinction. There are many problems that have come from this, but what are some of the main problems that you see from this now intersection of the comeback of wild species to suburbs? I mean, you talk about sprawl. Is it just that we have moved into the territory of these species?
One argument is that we're having all these problems with all these species because we've expanded into their habitat, and that's true, but it's only half the story. And the other half, which I find most interesting, is that these species encroach on our habitat right back. And the reason I say in the book is simple: our habitat's better than theirs in many cases for many species. We create this wonderful countryside full of stuff to eat, full of places to hide, water sources, edges, and so on. We put out grass and gardens and landscaping and bird seed and mulch and garbage and stuff in dumpsters, and we're essentially aggregating wild creatures to come and live amongst us. And when they take us up on it, we tend to have problems with them. I mean, we don't necessarily need to have problems. There's all sorts of stuff you can do to avoid those problems, but a lot of people don't know what to do when the skunk turns up on the back porch. You know, call 911 or something. I mean, it's one thing when that happens. It's another thing when the bear turns up in your garbage can or your bird feeder. And lots of people have trouble with deer. I mean, we hit 3,000 to 4,000 drivers hit about 3,000 to 4,000 deer per day in this country, and that's a pretty serious problem. Those crashes kill about 250 a year. They put another 29,000 or so in the hospital, and of course 1 to 2 million deer are killed as well. So this is a problem not only for people but for deer. I mean, geese are mostly a nuisance until they fly in front of your airplane. And there's something to worry about. I worry about them every time I board a plane at a New York airport. Turkeys, I don't know. Coyotes, you can carry a couple of rocks around or a golf club and frighten them away. So most of these are, a lot of these are perception problems rather than real people-wildlife problems. But there are truly serious problems. And one of the things that I say in the book is that we divide up into which animal we want to save and which animal we want to protect. Some people want to protect beavers from cruel traps, and other people want to save their lawns and wells and sewer systems and trees from beavers. In the case of deer, you've got very serious ecosystem problems. And when that happens, when you have deer eating out the understories of forests, there's no forest regeneration in lots of places in the Northeast these days. And when they eat out the understory, the birds that live there are threatened. For example, you eat the understory, the plants and bushes and so on the forest floor, and that's where the insects normally are that the birds gather to feed their babies. Remember, baby birds eat live protein, not bird seed. And when you, I mean, you're putting them at risk when the parents can't find food for them. So these conflicts are getting worse as populations of a lot of these creatures grow. But there are all sorts of ways that, depending on the species, to mitigate them. In the case of deer, you know, that's problematic, and we can talk about that.
Yeah, I'd like to. But first, let's go back a little bit more into some of the history, which is really fascinating that you tell Jim Sterba in this book, Nature Wars. You know, when the Europeans first came here, they saw vast forests, forests that you said had already been changed by the hand of humans. And and then they cut them down. So talk a little bit about what they found and what they did, and then what's happened since then.
Interestingly, we think of our forests as being in the West somehow, because the most recent logging and spotted owl controversy and so on happened in the West. But in reality, three-quarters of the forests of the United States, excluding Alaska's, are in the eastern third of the country, from the Atlantic coast out to the Great Plains. And that part of the country, you know, had a few million Native Americans, and they did their best to manage forests. They farmed forests because they had things that they wanted to do, like create habitat for the species that they counted on to eat and to get fur to wear, for example. They burned understories of forests to create sight lines so that their enemies couldn't sneak up on them, to control insects like mosquitoes, to grow bushes, berries, for example, that wild turkeys might be attracted to, and that deer would fresh browse for deer to come. So they were forest managers, and Europeans came, and essentially in the first 100 years started the fur trade, which was essentially buying beaver pelts and deer hides from Indians who went out and killed them and sold them to us for what we think of, what we've, as a cliche, called trinkets. But the things that we traded for those pelts, which they had a lot of, were iron pots and axes and all sorts of, the iPads of the day. And so this was a good relationship. But it essentially, the fur trade, beaver pelts and deer hides, essentially paid for the exploration of North America for the first 100 years before settlers got here. And the settlers were along the coast, and they, you know, they killed stuff and they cut down trees, but their numbers were so small that they really didn't have much of an impact. And it wasn't until the 19th century when immigrants began to pour in and the need for wild species to eat led to the creation of industries, businesses made up of market hunters who went out and killed wildlife and sold it for whatever purposes, to meat markets and to furriers and to hat makers and to pillow stuffers and all sorts of other people who wanted the products that these commercial hunters hunted and delivered. And as a result of that, populations shrank in areas where they were concentrated, and then as we moved west, they shrank some more. And by the end of the 19th century, you had these enormous depletions of wild species. I mean, people think there may have been 30 or 35 million deer in the year 1600. By 1900, there were only 350,000 left in the whole country. These are estimates, of course. Turkeys, tens of millions of turkeys were down to no more than 30,000. Imagine that. Beavers, maybe nobody knows, 50, 100 million beavers in this country, down to just really remnant populations, mainly in the Canadian outback. In the Adirondacks, for example, in 1905, I think there was a single family of 5 beavers left. And on and on. The waterfowl populations were decimated. Migrating ducks and geese were really almost gone, and so on. And it was only at this period when a few guys, mostly in the East, a few rich people who wanted to sport hunt and fish and so on, got together and began talking with people like Theodore Roosevelt about the whole idea that wildlife and forests in this country could be wiped out. And that really was the beginning of the conservation movement and the beginning of laws being passed to stop market hunting, to adopt what's been called the North American model of wildlife conservation, to stop cutting down trees or to at least manage them. In the case of forests, however, one of the interesting things that happened is that as the Midwest opened up, the Ohio Valley, people moved out there and found rich soil and cut down the trees there. But farmers in the Northeast began to abandon their marginal fields, their rocky fields, the fields on hills and so on, and forests took them back. And that happened over a period of 150 years or so, starting, depending on where you are, probably the low point in forestation was about 1880 in this countrywide. But then trees have been growing back ever since. They grew back under the noses of several generations, and those generations didn't see it happening. And if you ask people today, they don't believe it happened.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jim Sterba about his book, Nature Wars. It's about the resurgence of wildlife into areas of human habitation and the resulting struggles to balance human and wildlife needs.
You can only really, in some ways, see it from the air. I know whenever I've, flown into Kennedy Airport or gone from Kennedy Airport up to Hartford, you notice that we are, as you call them, forest dwellers. Yet it's a different kind of forest, and this was one question that I had. I mean, it's not a contiguous forest the way it used to be. Doesn't that cause an imbalance of species where some can flourish? Those species that flourish at the edges of forests are doing just great, but those that need a more contiguous forest are just as endangered as ever.
Well, there are migration routes and corridors that some species need, but I think they're all doing rather well. I mean, in the whole process of doing this book, I asked everyone who told me that, name six species larger than a rabbit that has not thrived in the new forested sprawl or among people. You know, there are 2,000 coyotes in downtown Chicago these days. There are cougars living in Boulder, coming in and out of Boulder, Colorado. You know, these forests are full of sewer lines and power lines and highways. And of course, there are these corridor problems, highways that, for example, Florida panthers can't cross. Highway I-75 that runs up Florida is a big... But they built underpasses under those for Florida bears and cougars to go under. And you're right, you know, the more corridors that people establish, the better off for the health and genetics and biodiversity. But it's surprising to me how well a lot of these species have adapted. And I'm reminded when you talked about flying and seeing forests, what John Gordon, the former head of the Yale School of Forestry, said about Connecticut, which is now more than 60% forested. He said, if you look down at Connecticut in the summer, what you'll see is almost unbroken forest. What if you waited until all of the leaves dropped off of those trees in the late fall, what you'd see is stockbrokers.
A whole other species.
Right.
So let's talk about deer. They're a particularly, you know, flammable subject in many communities, including the one in which I live. I live now on the east end of Long Island. It's a place that's plagued by serious Lyme disease. They estimate something like 30% of the inhabitants, human inhabitants, are infected by Lyme, which is carried by the deer tick, and where motorists risk crashing into deer on a regular basis. I mean, I'm always cautious when I'm in my car. Recently, there was a plan that had been passed by local municipalities to hire sharpshooters to bring down the deer population, and it was canceled at the last minute due to a lawsuit that was threatened by an extremely vocal group of residents who wanted to protect Bambi, because really, Bambi is what they were talking about. There were all kinds of arguments that they made. And there are arguments that you say in this book, Nature Wars, are ones that are applied by the animal protection groups to almost any species that is on the table for some kind of population control. Talk about the arguments that the animal protection groups bring to these and deconstruct them a bit.
First of all, these fights are going on in literally thousands of communities all over the deer's historic range, which is the eastern third of the United States. Literally, I didn't realize how many communities are having problems with deer and or other species, but mostly deer. And these deer fights that I've been to endless deer problem meetings in communities, and I can tell you that the average deer fight in one of these communities lasts about 10 years. And, you know, I call the deer chapter in my book The Elegant Ungulate. And that's one reason people want to protect them. They're beautiful creatures, you know. Who'd want to hurt a poor little deer? It's only when a species reaches what, I mean, the biological carrying capacity for deer in the suburbs where you live and in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and in all over Massachusetts is much greater. All the places where there are sprawl, and remember, a majority of Americans now live in the sprawl. The biological carrying capacity of that landscape is much higher for deer and lots of other species than is an unpeopled forest. You know, you can have 10 to 15 deer per square mile in an unpeopled forest, and that's considered okay. You get up to 20, and they start to damage their habitat. Well, I know endless suburbs, where including those in eastern Long Island, that have 40, 80, more than 100 deer per square mile. And one of the argument that they're degrading the ecosystem is a pretty recent one. And it's begun to resonate among people when they see their trillium are gone. There's no forest regeneration. All the seedlings have been eaten out.
I can attest to that because I live in the middle of a 14-acre woodlot or forest. And it's very different than it used to be. It seems like there are many more older trees crashing down and not that many new trees coming up.
Well, I think that, as I said, that the ecological damage argument is beginning to take hold among people who respond to questions about too many deer or arguments about too many deer. I mean, the counter arguments are, well, you know, put up a fence, drive carefully. You can do all sorts of things to mitigate. You know, there are even tick removal fences and so on. And, you know, you can do things to protect yourself from deer. I say in the book that there are some places out in eastern Long Island that people who live in joke that they live in prisoner of war camps because of the deer fences all over the place. What happens is that you eventually in these communities reach a what's called a social carrying capacity, a kind of a tipping point where the nuisance or damaging aspects of a species outweigh the virtues of the species in the public mind. And of course, the public takes years and years and years to make up their mind. And, you know, 10 people with a website and a couple of lawsuits can retard that progress for years and years and years. And what most people, in my experience, don't want to do is to kill deer or any other wild species. You know, so for the first 5 years of this fight, they'll argue about, how do you know we have too many deer?
Exactly.
How many deer do we have? Let's find out. So you can hire a helicopter with infrared capability to go in and do a survey and actually find out how many deer you have per square mile. Some of them are better than others. And that'll cost your town, you know, $5,000 in taxpayer dollars. And then, then you can hire a deer consultant for another $15,000 who will go in and study, and he'll come back and say, you've got a deer problem. You've got too many. What should you do? You should kill some. But he doesn't, these guys are really savvy to suburbia speak these days, so they don't use the K word because nobody wants to hear the K word. So he recommends a systematic program of human-directed mortality. And everybody boos him at the meeting. And then somebody says, okay, we now know that we're going to have to call the herd. How do we do it? Do we use tax dollars to hire sharpshooters? Somebody stands up in the back of the room and says, oh, come on, there are deer hunters around here. They're bow hunters. They'll do the job. They'll do it cheaply and easily. All you have to do is give us exclusive rights to hunt deer and East Hampton, say, and they have their own private hunting preserve. Somebody will get up and say, you don't have to kill things because contraception works. I know because I've been out to Colorado where they put contraceptive chemicals in the salt licks, and that solved the problem. The solution is way over the mountain somewhere.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Jim Sterba about his book, Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds. Well, let's talk about that last about contraception, because I've definitely heard these. I mean, first of all, you know, those people who don't want the deer killed or culled,
whatever you want to call it. Yeah,
you know, they're saying yes, we can use the fertility, the contraception. What's wrong with contraception? Could it work?
Yeah, it works. I mean, it works if you put up a high fence and you dart all the females every year or so, or every 2 years. Eventually, you know, you keep out infiltrators. Eventually, that deer herd will age and die of old age or something else. In the meantime, they're still out there on the landscape. They're still causing, through their eating habits, the problems that you have to begin with. There are some experiments that are going on now that may prove that contraception is an answer, but right now it's neither affordable or practical in free-roaming herds unless you can get the does to line up for their shots, which is not easy. You can catch them and surgically sterilize them, which they did in Cayuga Heights near Ithaca, Cornell, at a cost of about $1,200 per female, which is, you know, if you've got deep tax pockets, is fine. But most communities that I know are not, would like to spend their tax dollars on something else. So contraception may be the magic bullet down the road. But remember that deer hunters kill about 6 million deer a year in this country, and they do a pretty good job of managing deer populations in rural areas, but not in the sprawl where deer are multiplying the most, mainly because of hunting restrictions. You know, people think hunters are unsafe, and they passed all sorts of laws about the discharge of firearms, and I had the Massachusetts Wildlife Department do a study for my book about laws which deter deer control. And there are two. Most states have a couple of laws. One of is you can't discharge a firearm within 150 feet of a hard surface road or so, or within 500 feet of an occupied dwelling without the occupant's written permission, which isn't easy to get because a lot of suburbanites are against hunting. For various reasons, they think it's inhumane, they think it's unsafe. Well, those two laws alone put two-thirds of the state of Massachusetts essentially off limits to hunting. And I thought at one point if I was going to concentrate on deer that I'd call my book What Deer Want. Well, that's what they want. That's exactly what they want. And they've got it in the suburbs. And all these laws were adopted a few decades ago. In Westchester, you can't discharge a firearm in the whole county. But again, because hunters are perceived as being unsafe. But the problem is that hunters do kill people. I mean, they kill about 100 people a year, mostly each other in cases of mistaken identity. Guns, on the other hand, kill 31,000 people a year. Hunters kill about 100. Well, look what's happened to deer. Deer now kill more than twice that many people a year. So which is more unsafe, deer or hunters? That's one of the questions people have begun to ask.
And what about the sharpshooters? What do you think of that? And I have to say, by this line of questioning, I'm fully aware that there are people out there listening who are saying you shouldn't be killing any of them at all. They're animals. They have just as much a right to exist as we do.
I'll talk about sharpshooters in a second. In order to stabilize the whitetails population, the rule of thumb is that two-thirds of the females in any given area have to die every year. Remember, I mean, that's a pretty sizable number. How are they going to do that? Well, if you look in the aggregate, hunters kill maybe 6 million deer, half of them bucks, half does. Maybe the ratio is a little more skewed. Cars kill another, let's say, 2 million. And let's say all other causes, disease, whatever, kill another 6 million. Well, that's a total of 14 million deer that die every year for various reasons. Now, if the population is what people think it is, anywhere from 30 to 50 million, let's say 40, then killing 16 million does doesn't begin to even stabilize the deer population, let alone lowering it. The numbers I heard for Eastern Long Island are that there are, you know, 35,000 deer, and that the sharpshooters wanted to call maximum 3,500. That's not going to begin to address the problem. People who don't want to kill animals, I can sympathize with. I mean, they've had 100 years of education in the form of books and movies and TV about how wonderful human-like and childlike these beautiful creatures are. And they are, until you begin to realize that we have an obligation as a keystone species to manage them for the good of the whole ecosystem that we live in, and, you know, the plants, the animals, and even the people, for goodness sakes.
That was Jim Sterba. We talk with him more about nature wars after the break.
Here we are, like we're gonna get war again. Coming hard, come and get a gun, join the gang. With the bang bang and the same song we sang, coming over and over again. Picking up now, getting more like a game. Then it feels real like we'll under fake the fame. And there's never more than one truth, but you can't always tell your better half.
Always tell your better half of the story. Goes well with the better side of your face you show on TV. Give me a good reason why I shouldn't start a revolution. What's in the Constitution? It's this illusion that we buy. You cut the wings and then you say fly. You say the hero is the one that die, but the true hero is the one that doesn't live a lie and understand that there's an end out of the cycle. Who's the master? Who's the disciple? You can do what you can, but will you do it again? So what's the plan? Looks like we're gonna get war again. Gonna get war again.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. All over America, wildlife is making a comeback in urban and suburban neighborhoods, and it's pitting pro-wildlife advocates against residents who say their properties, ecosystems, and even lives are being endangered. My guest Jim Sterba has written a book about these battles. It's called Nature Wars. Just before the break, Sterba was saying that humans are a keystone species that have a responsibility to manage wildlife for the good of the entire ecosystem. A couple of years ago, I was walking along here and I saw what I thought was a coyote, although now I think it was actually a fox. But it seemed like a very large fox. And when I told people around here that I thought I'd seen a coyote, there was a lot of surprise because they hadn't been seen in this region before. But I'll never forget one person's reaction which was, you know, to me, I was happy because I thought, great, coyote, maybe they'll control the deer population if they come in, naively. But then another person, a person I was talking to, said, no, they're going to kill my dog. So I think what you're pointing out here, that humans are a keystone species, and that before we were around to control the deer population, there were wolves and coyotes and bobcats and things like that.
Well, here's an interesting story. One of the arguments that you get against people killing animals, and deer especially, is that one of the solutions that's proposed at all these deer problem meetings that I've been to is, let's just bring back natural predators. And coyotes kill fawns, bears kill fawns, there are a few other creatures, eagles and other raptors and so on, will kill some deer, some fawns, mostly. But wolves and cougars are major deer predators, and they kill deer to eat. They count on killing deer to eat. And they're coming east, no question about it, and eventually they're going to be around. They're beginning to show up. The question is, what would eastern Long Island and other places be like if cougars and wolves were around? I mean, it would certainly make people into better visual naturalists. They'd really pay attention to where they walked and what time and so on out there. Here's the interesting part about bringing back natural predators, which I point out in the talks that I give. There's one other natural predator that's worth mentioning here, and the studies that I know of have suggested that this predator has historically killed more deer than all other predators combined since the end of the last ice age, 11,000 years ago, and that predator is us. Man is the major deer predator by far, but look what's happened in the sprawl. Sprawl man essentially has gotten out of the predation business. He doesn't hunt deer. He doesn't like people around him to hunt deer. And so for the first, there's huge swaths of the deer's historic range, which is in the eastern United States, huge swaths, because half of us, the majority of us now live in this suburban sprawl, huge swaths of the natural deer habitat historically for the first time in 11,000 years, and that's just in the last few decades, are off limits to its biggest predator. And that essentially is the problem in a nutshell, I think, with deer, is that we don't want to be predators, and so we're suffering the consequences.
Now, another animal that you get into, you mentioned before, was the beaver. I also have a personal experience with the beaver because my mother at one point had some land in western Massachusetts, which went about a third underwater when a beaver dam was built. So beavers were also on the brink of extinction. They were, because of the fur trade, as you write about in the book, they were imported from, I guess, Canada, and there was restocking of the beaver, and now I'm not sure how I feel about them after reading your book. I mean, they've been causing a lot of problems, which I'd like to ask you to list what the problems were, but they also have been very important in restoring wetlands and the filtration that wetlands give to pollutants. So they have some good services for humans as well.
Oh, yeah. Beavers are really cool, I think. And they're vital. They're a keystone species like humans. They re-engineer the landscape. They create meadowlands. They create wetlands. By building their dams, they slow down water so the nutrients in the water settle into the bottom and then gradually fill up, and you've got these beautiful, which when settlers first arrive, the beavers were gone because they'd been trapped out by the explorers and Indians and the trappers in the fur trade, and the settlers in Massachusetts Bay Colony and Jamestown and other places went west a little ways and found these beautiful meadows that beavers had created, but of course the beavers were gone, and those meadows sold for premium prices to people who wanted to farm them and so on. This is premium land to those people. But, yeah, I mean, the problem with beavers are essentially that beavers and people share the same tastes in waterfront real estate, except that we plant trees and they like to chew them down. And as beavers grow, you know, they kick their kits out of the lodge when they're a year or so old. And those kits, like bears or lots of other species, have to go find some new territory. They can't live in their parents' territory. They have to find some new territory, which means running water and trees. Essentially, those are the two essentials for beavers. And so they're going to come into places where people are living. And there are ways besides trapping them out. You can trap them out, and eventually some new ones are going to come back, but it may take a few years. But you can install what's called beaver deceivers, which is a series of pipes and fences that keep the flood levels down on whatever they've dammed up without them being able to block the passage of the water. But they're pretty expensive. But no, I really think beavers are wonderful, but there are no predators. Trappers are a dying species in this country, and most of them are sort of weekend recreational things. And lots of places like Massachusetts have passed laws banning what have been called cruel, inhumane traps, and so there are fewer and fewer ways to control the beaver population.
Well, that was very interesting because you mentioned a vote on the trapping issue. I actually voted to ban the lethal traps. I was in western Massachusetts when that came up for a vote. But you say it's kind of a case of emotion ruling over science, because the consequences of that vote, banning the lethal traps, was not exactly all that wonderful for the beaver.
Well, what happened was that beavers ended up just as dead as they would in the traps. By the way, one of those cruel traps that was banned, which Massachusetts voters didn't know about when they voted to ban it, was awarded by Queen Elizabeth a prize in British Columbia for the guy who built it, Fred Conybear, as a more humane trap to use than a leg hold trap, or a foothold trap. So here's a trap that had been celebrated as more humane. that is being banned in Massachusetts as being cruel. So it's kind of relative. What's happened in Massachusetts is that after the ban, the beaver population spiked to about three times what it was. It was about 20,000, and this, as I say, the social carrying capacity of the beavers hadn't been breached yet. The tipping point hadn't come along because, I mean, they damaged some things out in western Massachusetts, but they weren't all over the place, and people, farmers, could deal with them in some illicit ways, one of them which was euphemistically called high-speed lead poisoning. But after the ban, the population shot up to about 60,000 or more, and the Massachusetts Wildlife Department was doing nothing but getting problem beaver complaints, and so they had the legislature delegate the handling of damaging beavers to municipal health departments, which had no experience and no knowledge and so on. And so you had 351 municipalities making decisions about whether one beaver was damaging and another wasn't. Some of them were anti-trapping beavers. Some of them were forehand. And it turned out to be a mess, but they could issue special licenses to nuisance wildlife trappers to kill beavers with the old traps. And nobody really knows because the numbers are not collected well. But the thought is that probably just as many beavers are being killed today in Massachusetts as were being killed by the trappers in the old days, except that it just goes on under the radar. It's kind of sub rosa now. And everybody sort of thinks out of sight, out of mind.
But you also say that, you know, they mandated traps that were the so-called humane traps, these, you know, kind of cages, so trap and relocation. And you say that relocation is often a death sentence itself.
Well, that's why it's illegal in many, if not most, states, because, first of all, and it's illegal in Massachusetts, for example. So, yeah, if you catch an animal, he's in this suitcase-type trap in the water for several hours before you get there, maybe a day or so. He's being traumatized by that. Then the mortality rate for all sort of transported wildlife is high because they're under a lot of stress. And you put this animal out in some other area, some nice new glen or stream, where there are already beavers that he's now got to compete with, or some other species that he's got to compete with. Maybe your beaver has got some sort of disease which he's going to spread to these species that are already out there. And for this and other reasons, wildlife biologists just say that it's generally unhealthy to relocate species. So what you have, ironically, is these beavers being caught in humane traps, these suitcase traps. They're caught alive, and they're taken out, and they can't be transported, so they're euthanized, you know, usually with a .22 caliber bullet through the back of the head. And they end up just as dead, and they end up, they're given to guys who skin them and sell them to the fur market, and they end up in Russia or China being made into beaver skin whatnots for just like in the old days, except that it sort of goes on and people think that they've done the right thing by saving beavers.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Jim Sterba about his book Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks. Now, you mentioned those traps. That also comes up in the huge fight between cat lovers and people who are trying to protect birds from cat, feral cat, or even domestic cat depredations. That's a big subject. So I'd like to zero in on the problem of feral cats and the trap and release programs for them. This is the accepted way of doing it. You're supposed to trap, neuter, and then release right back into the place where they found them, these feral cats. Was it right that you had a feral cat around your property as well?
Cats turn up around us in our weekend place, 90 miles north of the city in Dutchess County. Some of them are owned, some of them I don't know, but yeah, they're around.
So what do you think of trap, neuter, and release programs?
Well, the Humane Society of the United States, which used to be against trap neuter return, called it trap neuter reabandonment, because you're putting the cats out to live kind of these short, kind of brutal lives that they, by themselves, even if people are out there feeding them and caring for them. But the pro-TNR people say, oh, these are community cats, they're being looked at, they're being looked after fine, and that this is a wonderful thing. You know, ask the bird people what they think. I mean, they think it's a tragedy because you're putting this creature out to prey on birds and small mammals. Remember, this is an introduced species. This is a mid-sized North African predator on the landscape. And, you know, there are a lot of places where people think they're doing a really good job of protecting these colonies of community cats. And maybe they are. Maybe they feel good about it. But when you just look at the dimensions of the problem, which I do in the book, I think that, first of all, there's no real serious, other than anecdotal evidence, that these programs actually reduce the feral cat population. And the American Pet Products Association's convention was just a few weeks ago in Orlando, and they now estimate that the number of owned cats in this country is 95 million. And people have said that as a rule of thumb, they think there are just as many feral cats out there as owned cats. And that means if you add the house cats, the kept cats, and the feral cats together, you have 190 million of this introduced species out there on the landscape. And just to give you some perspective, that's more cats, both feral and house cats, than the total number of cattle, sheep, goats, pigs, and horses combined in this country. And when you think that there were only an estimated 4 million cats in 1947 when kitty litter was invented, you can sort of see how this problem has mushroomed. And I, you know, I feel sorry for the cats, but this, like many wildlife issues, is a people problem. I mean, we've made it so easy to acquire cats and so easy for us to throw them away when, you know, like yesterday's pair of shoes or handbag, when they're out of fashion or when they cause a problem, when they scratch the furniture or when we have to move someplace and we can't take them with us. And we can just dump these poor cats out. And you know, these people are doing the Lord's work, they believe, and you got to sympathize with them for helping these poor little creatures. But this is a people problem, not a cat problem, and I think we have to get a lot tougher with people dealing with cats. I mean, not only do we have to get them spayed and neutered and so on, but we ought to have them chipped so that we know if people throw their cat away, exactly who threw it away or who owned it. And the other problem with trap neuter return is just that it's logistically problematic nationally. Think about it. There are about 60,000 working veterinarians in this country, and about 46,000 of them are pet veterinarians. In other words, they specialize essentially in dogs and cats. And if you just look at the numbers, if each pet vet sterilized, trap neutered, which is essentially, remember, a hysterectomy for a female cat. It's not simple. It's not easy. It takes time, and it's, if you had to pay for it, it's pretty expensive. But if each one of these vets did that to 100 cats a year, you know, we're talking 4.6 million neutered cats. And if they did one a day for a year, you'd get up to 16, almost 17 million neutered cats. But 17 million, like deer, does not begin to lower the total numbers, because if there are that many feral cats out there, and just take any number you want, and you only get 16 million of them, and half of the remaining ones are females, you know, say 25 million females, and they each have two litters a year, and let's say only two of the cats in the four cat litter survive, you're still growing the total feral cat population. Just the mathematics of it don't make sense to me.
And what are they doing to the bird population?
Well, depends on who you believe. I mean, the bird people will say they kill 5 billion birds. Pick your number. you know, whatever number you choose, the cat people say, you know, the things we do are killing more birds than the poor little cats are. They fly into our windows and to our windmills and all this kind of stuff. And to take the pro-cat argument, for example, let's say they're killing 5 billion birds a year in this country. Well, there are, at the beginning, in the spring, the population of birds that migrate back and forth may be 10 billion. And by the end of the migrating, they may get up to 20 billion by the time that they've all had chicks or raised and so on. But then by the end of the year, they're back down through predation and all sorts of other things down to maybe 10 million. So maybe out of 20 billion birds, 10 billion die, and cats are responsible for half. Well, that's still a lot. But there are other factors, and you know, you can argue as a pro-cat person that this is something that is not the main cause of avian mortality. All the bird people will tell you it's the main preventable cause of avian bird mortality.
So finally, you said in the beginning that we could, in fact, make this work for the animals and for us. Well, I don't know if you said it in that way, but that's what I took from what you said. What are some of the things, what are some of those suggestions or recommendations that you would have for dealing with these nature wars?
Well, first of all, there's a need for a serious education program. There are all sorts of things that we can do to mitigate people-wildlife conflicts. And the nuisance wildlife control businesses, which are booming in this country, will tell you that that you've got to remove the food sources from around your house if you want to stop wildlife from coming along. On the other hand, you've got another booming business, which is the habitat enhancement business, where you can hire companies to build you these beautiful ponds and landscaping that are actually designed to attract wildlife, to bring it in. So you've got one business that's appealing to you to lure wildlife in, and another business that's there on call to take nuisance wildlife out. And they're both in the business of nature management. They're both managing nature, and so are we in ways that we know or don't know. Whether we know it or not, we're ubiquitous on the landscape, and we're managing nature. Yet most of these same people who are out there and who want to build a pond to draw wildlife in or hire someone to take it out say leave nature alone, it will balance itself. It's well, you know, you have to convince people once again that nature's always out of balance and that we have an obligation as a keystone species to manage it for the good of the whole ecosystem. And that's just one thing. So that's an education effort. I think we have to make it tougher on people who think they're befriending wildlife but are really putting it in harm's way. I mean, you know, a bear shows up in your backyard, you should be trying to scare it away. Or a coyote, you shouldn't say, oh, get a donut, throw it out there, get a camera, oh wow, isn't this a wonderful bear, we can start an album of our bear. And pretty soon the bear is trying to break into your house, and you call 911, and you say, do something about your bear. So they take the bear away. The bear now associates the smell of people with food and not fear. They dart the bear. They take it 100 miles away, but he still has learned that people are not a threat and that there's food around people. So he goes to the next site, and, you know, the second or third time that he does this, the bear gets put down as a threat to the population, and it's not the bear's fault, it's the people's fault. So people have to relearn that wildlife is wildlife. They're not pets, they're not children, they're wild animals, they behave like wild animals, they don't behave like Disney characters, and or like the images that we see in the indirect nature that we've gotten for all these decades from on digital screens and TV and movies and so on. So that's just, and then, you know, there are all sorts of other mitigating factors. You know, you can put up a fence, you can put out stuff that'll deter, you can plant things that deer don't like, you can You can put up a beaver deceiver, keep your local beavers. Whether they're going to chew down your prized birch tree is another issue. But geese, you know, you can scare them away, but you're probably scaring them to someplace else where there's somebody else's problem. Turkeys, you know, they're big, intimidating birds, but they're, you know, they chase mailmen and children around a little bit. They're not really a threat. And on and on and on like that. So, and there are all sorts of things out there on the internet and so on, and all sorts of businesses for hire that'll teach you or how to mitigate wildlife damage problems or do it for you for a hefty fee.
Well, your book, Jim Sterba, will help readers understand all of that and more. It's called Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turn backyards into battlegrounds. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It was my pleasure.
Go to writersvoice.net to hear an excerpt from Jim Sterba's book, Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turn backyards into battlegrounds. We have just enough time for a poem. Let's do one about birds from Billy Collins. It's called Ornithography.
A poem called that I call Ornithography, which would mean the writings of birds. And I haven't looked this up in the dictionary. It's a pretty new poem, but I'd be surprised and impressed if there were such a word that would describe the writings of birds. And it also has a little epigraph. It came out of a reading that there's a legendary Chinese figure. His name is Kong Yi, I think. And he was said to have invented writing after observing the tracks of birds. So that got it started. Ornithography. A light snow last night, and now the earth falls open to a new page. A cold wind is breaking up the clouds. Children wait for their yellow bus in a huddle. And under the feeder, some birds are busy writing poems, stories, and letters to their mothers. A crow is working on an editorial. That chickadee is compiling a list. And the robin walks back and forth, composing the opening to her autobiography. All so prolific this morning, these expressive little creatures, and each with an alphabet of only two letters. A far cry from me, here in silence behind a window, as silent as they are whenever they take to flight, having nothing more to say. Thank you.
That was Billy Collins reading his poem, Ornithography, from a CD of a performance at Symphony Space in New York City in 2005. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.